Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about Irish step dancing. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kristen Dowell. She's assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Oklahoma, and she will be speaking tonight, March 10th, at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum in a lecture titled Breaking New Cinematic Ground, Aboriginal Canadian Experimental Videos, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So you are showing some videotapes made by, is the word Aboriginal in Canada what we would say Native American here?
Yes, so the term Aboriginal tends to get used more in Canada, as well as the term First Nations, just in terms of highlighting the Indigenous sovereignty and nationhood of the Indigenous groups of Canada. But I use the term Aboriginal broadly to encompass, because the people that I'm working with have come from a range of different tribal backgrounds, and so Aboriginal is more of it's a term that can encompass all of those different backgrounds that people have. So it's analogous to Native American.
And so you've got people, and are you working with these filmmakers personally? Are you studying what they do?
Yes. So the two filmmakers whose work I'll be talking about, Kevin Burton and Helen Haig Brown, are filmmakers that I met back in 2003 when I first started my research on Aboriginal media in Vancouver. Although neither of them actually lives in Vancouver now, but my research is based with filmmakers in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I'm looking at the on and off screen impact of Aboriginal media production in Canada. As an anthropologist of media, I'm really interested in the kind of off screen, behind the scenes, the social life behind the production of the media practice. So I'm really interested in how being engaged in practices of media production can help create new forms of social relationships across tribal backgrounds in the urban context, how it can help sort of reestablish intergenerational ties or community ties between urban and reserve communities, and just the kind of the sort of social life of the media production off screen.
And so what have you found? What is happening off screen?
Well, to me, there's a couple things that are really interesting as an anthropologist. One is that Indigenous filmmakers, not just in Vancouver and in Canada, but really around the world, because this is a global media movement now, but there are ways in which the media technology gets incorporated in very culturally specific ways. So people in the production process can incorporate protocols into that process, and that can be anything from consulting with elders on set in terms of location scouting, or having folks say prayers or ceremony or smudging on set. It can be reflected in the editing practices.
Is there something which you might say is Aboriginal editing style?
Well, I don't want to overgeneralize, because every filmmaker also is working within their own individual artistic framework and perspective as well. But I would say that for some Indigenous media production in Canada, the editing style is quite a bit different. It might have longer, quote-unquote, talking head shots. In other words, if it's an elder that's speaking on screen, some filmmakers feel like it's inappropriate to interrupt them and use B-roll in the way that a kind of standard documentary, more PBS-style documentary might do. You might have slower pacing in the editing. You might have the use of... One of the things that I'll be talking about is the use of land, language, and cosmology in these films. So the way in which the land is represented, the way that it's framed, the iconography that gets used, and languages are all ways in which Aboriginal filmmakers are drawing on the specific cultural traditions and aesthetic frames of their own tribal backgrounds and bringing that into the media production process.
One of the films has a person speaking English with a Cree-speaking person. Is that right?
Right. So the film is called Nikamowin, which translates to song in Cree, and it's by director Kevin Burton. And he's a sort of rising star in Aboriginal media in Canada, I would say. And he works from a very particular Cree aesthetic. So for him, his films are all about speaking to Cree audiences, using the Cree language, and finding ways to represent his particular worldview through the media production process. So in Nicomowin, the Cree language itself becomes personified. And in the opening sequence, as a filmmaker, he's kind of having a dialogue with the Cree language itself about the importance of maintaining one's language, particularly in the urban context. So for him, as a Cree speaker, he grew up on a reserve in northeastern Manitoba called God's Lakes Narrows. He's a fluent Cree speaker, and Cree was his first language. He later moved to Vancouver in his early 20s, and in Vancouver, he had no Cree speakers to speak with, so he found that a very disorienting experience. And part of that experience, he wanted to translate to the screen, really as a way to encourage other urban native youth to speak their language, to learn their language if they don't know it, but just to keep those languages going.
Now, the aesthetic of it uses a lot of editing tricks and the same shot shown twice on a screen and things flipped around and a lot of sort of, I don't know exactly what the filmmaker terms are for these things. And I was thinking as I was watching it, I mean, it's so much in a way about experimenting with the tricks of film.
Yes.
But you're saying it's also Cree aesthetic somehow?
Yes. So my argument is that the experimental genre, because Aboriginal filmmakers in Canada and elsewhere are making a whole range of media. So they're making everything from feature films, short dramas, television shows, documentaries, community media. But the community that I work with in Vancouver has a very strong Aboriginal experimental video scene, media art, new media installation work. And I'm interested in that because I think the experimental genre really allows, it opens up ways for Aboriginal filmmakers to kind of redefine the screen in ways that fit within their own sort of cultural aesthetic or their own framework. So to me, what's interesting is he uses split screen distortion, audio distortion. The only audio track on the actual film is him speaking sounds in Cree that are raw. They're in raw and altered form, so they're distorted through the editing process. And he also uses split screen to kind of juxtapose images from his home reserve community and his traditional territory with the urban street scenes of Vancouver. And through his combination of both his production techniques in terms of how it's shot and the post-production techniques, but also his decisions about filming on his territory is a really important aspect of that kind of off-screen production process. So he's inspired by this territory that he grew up on, and he wanted to replicate that through the visual track of the film. So what he said to me was that when he made that film, he wanted to literally translate in a visual way how he hears and interprets the world as a Cree speaker. And so all of those audio bits are ways for him to represent his worldview, which is fundamentally shaped by the Cree, by being a Cree speaker.
So for the audience here who is probably, I'm guessing, 100% non-Cree speakers who don't know what that means...
Yeah.
How can you, like, help us understand what that means in terms of a different view than an urban non-Cree person making films in Vancouver?
How can a non-Cree audience understand and interpret the film?
Yeah.
Well, I think more generally some of the themes that come across through the film, I guess I would say there's two things. One is just the importance of language in general. So although he is articulating a Cree aesthetic for a Cree audience, he's also speaking to a broader Indigenous audience in the sense that he wants to encourage all Indigenous peoples to maintain their languages and to speak their language, to pick up their languages if they'd never learned it as children for a whole variety of reasons. There's a long history of intervention by the state, whether it's the U.S. government or the Canadian government historically, that sought to erase Indigenous languages. So kind of speaking back to that colonial legacy and saying it's important for our cultures in order to maintain our languages. But also he's speaking to one of the effects of the experimental techniques that he uses is he's basically able to take the Cree language and turn it into, through audio distortion and through all of the techniques that he uses in post-production, turn it into a hip-hop
exactly.
song, basically. So it's a way to appeal to a younger generation and try to encourage younger kids who, or, and especially urban kids who maybe don't, maybe they think learning their language isn't cool, or maybe they don't have, you know, access to elders or to communities to speak their language. It's a way to make it relevant to a younger generation of Aboriginal youth and to encourage them as well.
Now, is that a language that's mostly spoken by elders and not so much by youth?
Well, Cree, actually, in terms of language maintenance, I mean, Cree has a fair number of fluent speakers. A lot of Indigenous languages, both in the U.S. and in Canada, are what some linguistic anthropologists refer to as endangered languages, or they're losing speakers as an elder generation passes on. I think the Cree language actually has a fair number of speakers, but there's always need, you know, to still encourage and to inspire other, especially youth, to continue to maintain their language and to think about the ways in which language can be integrated into media technology. So the way that the tools of media production can be made to speak to the needs of Indigenous communities. That's one of the things that I'm interested in, the way in which this media technology can get appropriated and used in ways and put into the service of the cultural needs of Aboriginal communities.
Are films like that going back to the reserve?
That film has tended to be seen more in art contexts, certainly in the art museum. One of the reasons why I wanted to show these films here in Santa Fe is that in Canada, there's a lot of Aboriginal experimental media. I think Canadians in general are more exposed to experimental media. There's more of it that's getting produced, and that's because of a larger kind of institutional framework that supports art production in general in Canada, and Aboriginal art and media production specifically. There's Canada Council for the Arts, the National Film Board of Canada.
Yeah.
There's just an institutional framework there that helps to generate and to support and to train media artists.
So would that we had that here.
Yes, we would.
We're sitting here arguing about film credits and things like that. The Canadian film infrastructure is awesome.
It is. And it's put into place because of Canadian concerns around Canadian cultural sovereignty. They're concerned about the dominance of American media on their screens. So they have created these institutional frameworks as a way to try to support Canadian art and cultural production and media production generally, and they've incorporated and included Aboriginal media as part of that initiative. They've been funding Aboriginal media, at least at the National Film Board of Canada, since 1969. There's a long history of state support for Aboriginal media in Canada. They have Aboriginal People's Television Network, or APTN. It's the world's first national Indigenous television channel that launched in 1999. So it broadcasts Aboriginal media 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's available on all basic cable in Canada. So works like Nicomowin get broadcast on television stations like APTN. It also was shown, Nicomowin was named one of Canada's top 10 short films of 2008. And so it was screened really widely across Canada, both on a film festival circuit, but also it was broadcast. It has a distributor. So it's been seen in a number of different contexts, and certainly in both Aboriginal film festivals as well as mainstream film festivals as well. It screened at the Sundance Film Festival as part of their Native initiative. Actually, both of these films did.
And you were saying the reason you wanted to show it here?
Is because I feel like that American audiences don't have as many opportunities to see experimental media work, whether it's Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal.
Right.
And in particular for Aboriginal media production or Indigenous media production more broadly, if we think, you know, globally. I just think it's good to look at the whole range of work that's getting produced, not just documentaries or feature films that are successful. And I mean, those media are significant as well in terms of making an intervention into the politics of representation. But I think there also should be some attention paid to this more kind of avant-garde experimental artistic work as well.
We're talking to Kristen Dowell, who will be speaking tonight at the New Mexico History Museum in a lecture titled Breaking New Cinematic Ground, Aboriginal Canadian Experimental Videos. You said a moment ago something about languages, some native languages being called endangered, and there's a kind of obvious connection to endangered species, and in the biological context, there's a great danger when too many species go extinct because you then don't have biodiversity and ecosystems fall apart and things like that. Is there an analog in languages? When you lose linguistic diversity, do bad things happen?
Well, I should preface this by saying that I'm not a linguistic anthropologist, although I do work with linguistic anthropologists. And yes, for indigenous communities, for native activists who are concerned about language loss, they would say, yes, there is something that's lost when a community loses their language, because there is a very strong tie between language and culture. So for people in communities who are feeling concerned about the lower number of speakers, or certainly when elders pass away, they carry a tremendous amount of not just language knowledge, but knowledge about culture. So language is integrated into everything from place names related to territory to ceremony, as well as everyday kind of conversational aspects. There's something about the way in which worldview is connected to language, and that profound connection between language and culture. So that, yes, certainly for indigenous communities who are facing language loss, there's a great concern and a sense of urgency around what steps do we need to take in order to revitalize and to maintain our language so we don't lose any further, so we don't have any further language loss, and so we can encourage younger generations to learn the language. And there's a tremendous amount of cultural work all across indigenous communities in the U.S. and in Canada that is working towards revitalizing languages. So, for instance, I teach at the University of Oklahoma, and one of my colleagues, Dr. Mary Lynn, is a curator of native languages there. She runs the Oklahoma Native Youth Language Fair. There's a number of programs in Oklahoma with tribal communities who are creating language immersion programs, who are creating elder apprentice programs so that younger folks can apprentice with elder speakers of the language. In Canada, there's a television series called Finding Our Talk, which profiles success stories in language revitalization and language maintenance in Indigenous communities, First Nations communities in Canada, but also in Indigenous communities around the world. And that television show airs on APTN. And APTN broadcasts a certain percentage of its programming in Indigenous languages. I believe right now they're broadcasting in 14 different Indigenous languages. Not that all of their programming is in Indigenous languages, but media can be a really vital tool for helping to maintain languages, Indigenous languages.
Now, the other program that you're showing, or one of the other films that you're showing, is about a guy who's kind of a cowboy. Clearly, you can see in his face that he's got some probably Indian blood, and he goes in a hole and comes out in the spirit world.
Right. So that's the film called The Cave by director Helen Haig Brown, who's a Chilcotin woman from the Stoney First Nation, which is in the interior of BC, just outside of Williams Lake. And that film was produced as part of a film collective called the Embargo Collective, which was commissioned by the Imaginative Film Festival in Toronto, which is one of the largest Indigenous film and media festivals. It's held every October in Toronto. And for their 10th anniversary, they wanted to commission a set of films that would screen in 2009 at their 10th annual film festival. And Helen was selected as one of the 7 international Indigenous filmmakers to create a film for this particular festival. Now, each of the filmmakers was assigned a set of restrictions that they had to work within, and they were sort of pushed to work outside of the traditional genres that they work in. So Helen's work, actually, has made a range of documentaries, experimental documentaries, short films. She works collaboratively with Kevin Burton, the other filmmaker I'm profiling. So she's actually the cinematographer on the film Nicomoin. So they've worked together on a number of projects. She was assigned the science fiction genre, and this was her first short narrative film.
Oh, so it's like, here, take a genre, work with it.
Right. And also, I should say, too, in terms of language, all 7 of the films that were commissioned for that film festival were meant to be in languages other than English. So in fact, all of the films ended up being in indigenous languages. So her film, The Cave, is the first Chilcotin sci-fi film. It's shot in the Chilcotin language, was filmed on Chilcotin territory, and was a film project that was done collaboratively with her community. So there was a lot of... she incorporated people from her community in terms of consulting with elders, in terms of location scouting, you know, catering, production assistants, horse wranglers, you name it. There were, you know, a lot of folks who were helping out with the production of that film.
And so the people in it are not actors, they're people from the community.
Right, non-professional actors, yeah.
Right, and so the whole guy wakes up and he's in the spirit world and he's gone back 500 years or something like that?
Well, what happened, the story is actually based on a Chilcotin traditional story. And so what I was really interested in is how did the filmmaker translate this traditional oral story that's been told for generations among the Chilcotin, how does she translate that to the screen, and what sorts of decisions did she make in that process?
Right.
And to me, one of the interesting things is she had to make a sci-fi film. She wanted to think about how could you make a sci-fi film? How can you make a sci-fi film from an indigenous perspective and from a Chilcotin perspective? In other words, a lot of Western kind of Hollywood sci-fi films are about this, they're sort of reproducing a colonial narrative because they're about space, the final frontier, sort of
right.
about conquering alien worlds or going out and discovering new
yeah,
territory.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it?
And from an indigenous perspective, that's not, she didn't want to reproduce that type of colonial narrative, so she wanted to instead reimagine. So what I'm arguing with her film is that it's experimental because she's redefining the science fiction genre.
Although a lot of science fiction genres are about getting the heck off of a destroyed planet or something.
Right, which one might also argue is reflective also of the colonial experience in the sense of folks have destroyed this world through these acts of, you know, colonization or exploitation of resources, and now are forced to seek
right.
solace elsewhere, in which they may be encountering other, you know, aliens or other communities through that process. But at any rate, she wanted to think about how to, from a Chilcotin perspective, how can the science fiction genre be made to speak to Chilcotin cosmology. And in Chilcotin cosmology, the spirit world is a plane that exists at the same it sort of exists at the same time as the present world, but time operates in a very different way in the spirit world. So what happens for it's actually a bear hunter, the Chilcotin cowboy, he's a hunting bear, and he's out and he discovers this cave, goes into the cave, and unbeknownst to him, it's a portal to the spirit world. So he goes into the spirit world, he's kind of violated a cultural protocol by doing so because it's not his time to enter the spirit world yet. And so the figures that you see in the spirit world are ancestral figures. And when he comes back out of the cave, he realizes, he sees his horse, right, who's now no longer living. And so the spirit world, time exists in a different way in the spirit world. So what seems like it might only be a few minutes or a few hours in the kind of present everyday world is actually a very long time in the spirit world. So he's been in the spirit world, what to him seems like just a few minutes, but actually is years. And so the story is really, part of it is a moral narrative. It's about maintaining sort of cultural protocols around, she argues too that it can be read as a moral kind of narrative around bear hunting, which has a lot of cultural protocols in her community. Hunting bear is a very important part of Chilcotin life, and there's a lot of ceremony and spiritual aspects that go with that. And so some people read that story as that the bear hunter has violated norms or protocols around hunting bear, and that's why he enters the spirit world and then comes out and suffers the consequences in the sense of losing his horse. But anyway, so it's a traditional story, and she takes that story and makes it a narrative that can speak, I think, both to, certainly she's speaking to a Chilcotin audience, she's speaking to an indigenous audience, but it's also a film that has a lot of resonance with non-native audiences as well. And at the same time, she's paying homage to the cultural traditions and the community that she comes from. The narrator who opens the story is actually her great uncle, who was recorded in the 1970s in an audio recording telling that traditional story to the filmmaker's mother. So there's all these kinship ties to it as well. And she takes, to me, it's also interesting, it's kind of analog meeting digital in that film as well, because the analog recording became the opening sequence to set up the stage, to set the stage for the action in the film. And also thinking about, you know, the kinship ties, the legacy of the kinship ties through her connection to that story through her mother and her great uncle. And then the way in which that oral story can then become, that was the basis for the script for the film. So there's all these layers to storytelling in that film that I think are quite interesting in terms of Chilcotin. Again, cultural protocols, language, cosmology, and land. The land is absolutely a central character in that film.
And a lot of the sequences that don't have any dialogue at all are just shots of the land.
Yes.
Now, you were talking to Kristen Dowell, who will be speaking tonight. Are there many ties between Canadian and United States Native Indigenous filmmakers? Do they work with each other?
They do. There's a lot of collaboration back and forth. I would say that film festivals are a really important venue for Native filmmaking, both in terms of providing a distribution venue, providing a screening venue for the work, but also for the networks that get created amongst filmmakers in those film festivals.
Because they show up to the film festivals and meet each other.
Exactly. And here in the States, I would say the Sundance Film Festival is very key, because they have a Native and Indigenous film initiative.
Right.
So every year they're showcasing work by not only Native American filmmakers, but also international Indigenous filmmakers. And they've been really supportive as far as the Director's Lab and helping filmmakers to workshop their projects through the Sundance Institute. So that's been a really central venue here in the States. Certainly the Native American Film and Video Festival that's held every other year in New York is another really important, again, international. A lot of these film festivals now are international in scope, so it's bringing folks, Maori filmmakers from New Zealand, Aboriginal Australian filmmakers, Indigenous filmmakers from Brazil, Mexico, South America.
And then you get into these potential cliches of all Indigenous people share a love for the earth and these things, and as if everybody were kind of alike in their love and respect for Mother Earth, which may or may not really hold that much water.
Right. But the thing about the film festival, which I think is great if anyone has been to a Native film festival, is that you really get a sense of the wide range of work that people are making. So it's not just, I mean, I think you're right that there can be, and I certainly don't want to generalize that all Indigenous film is X, Y, and Z, or that all Indigenous film has a particular aesthetic. But I think, you know, attending a Native film festival, or certainly, you know, looking at the programming that's on APTN, it gives you a sense of the range and the diversity of whether it's the genres that people are working in. There's just some incredibly talented and creative artistic expression happening in a digital way through Aboriginal and Indigenous media. If listeners are interested, the Embargo Collective films, which were, again, commissioned by the Imaginative Film Festival in 2009, all seven of those films are currently on exhibit at the Museum of Contemporary Native American Arts on the plaza, and folks can check that out. I believe the exhibit is up until the middle of April.
Kristen Dowell is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Oklahoma, and once again, she'll be speaking tonight, the 10th of March, at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum. It's a lecture titled Breaking New Cinematic Ground, Aboriginal Canadian Experimental Videos, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research, that's on the web at sarweb.org. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Adrienne Bellis. She is Artistic Director of Bellisama Irish Dance, and Natalie Smith, who is Dance Captain. Their annual performance called Rhythm of Fire is happening this Saturday, the 12th of March at 7 o'clock, and then again Sunday, the 13th at 2:30 at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So tell us about this company, Irish Dance. Traditional Irish dance?
It's a fusion. We started out as traditional Irish dance, and then I like all sorts of stuff. I was trained as a jazz dancer, I've taken modern. I'm also a musician and singer, so I am eclectic. So we do the traditional, but we also incorporate, this year we have some swing jazz 40s in the show. We have a modern piece in the show that Kate Everly choreographed for us. And I like the variety.
And so one thing about Irish dance that's so striking is that the upper body and arms can be very still, and then the lower body and especially the feet are going bananas.
Yeah.
What's that all about historically?
The longest running rumor is that during the period of religious persecution in Ireland, that people danced in the fields or danced in their houses with their arms at their sides, so that if somebody looked in the window or saw people over the fields of grain or whatever they were growing, that they wouldn't see that they were dancing.
Maybe a little bit of hopping, no more.
Exactly.
Is that true? Do we have any way of verifying that?
No, not really. I've always heard it as a rumor, but it is the longest running, most popular one I've ever heard.
Well, it's striking how the top and the bottom are isolated from each other, certainly.
The other one is that in the pubs, it gets so crowded that you can't really use your arms anyways.
Right.
So there's also, and that's actually pretty practical in real life too, so.
Now, the feet are so percussive. They're part of the music itself, in a way.
And that's what I teach. I teach it really as a part of the music, as a rhythm. I play hand percussion, and I'm just really focused on the rhythm. And I try to choreograph, and the people who choreograph for me, it sort of works out that way, that we focus on that.
I think it's probably helpful for you as a dancer to also be a musician if you're teaching this kind of dance, which is almost a hybrid, in a way.
It has certainly been an asset for me. I think Natalie might speak to this a little bit, but I tend to talk in music. Is that true?
That's true. That's definitely
what
true.
What does that mean to you, Natalie?
Well, you know, she just sort of listened to the beats of the music rather than, like, where the music is going to change sort of thing. And, you know, it's just really interesting to think about it as the music changed rather than just how you're dancing.
I also speak in dum-dilly-umps.
Right.
Dum-da-dum-dum-dum-da-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum.
Now, Natalie, how did you start doing this kind of dance?
I started back when I was in second grade, which is like 10 years ago now, just as a way for me and my mom to bond. We just saw an ad in the newspaper, and we just tried it out one time, and we loved it. Both of us did. And my mom quit a couple years ago, but I'm still dancing, so.
And she's still backstage.
Yeah, she's still helping backstage this year, so.
That's interesting. Now, you've got bright red hair. Are you Irish?
I'm definitely Irish. My grandmother came over to Canada from Ireland.
Ah,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
So this kind of dance, this kind of music, what are the traditional instruments?
Well, fiddle definitely is one of them. The baron, the drum, and they weren't always as fancy. Barons weren't as fancy as they are now. They were, you know, skins wrapped over a frame and tied on or glued on or nailed on, however they could accommodate that. Penny whistle is pretty common, and a lot of people play box accordion or button accordion, small.
And then it's morphed into, in terms of the kind of performance that you're doing, and indeed the river dance and all those famous Irish performances that have been very popular, a really big sound that can be played in large auditoriums, concert halls, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, we're still fairly small because the James A isn't a huge auditorium, and I've heard bagpipes in the James A, and they're pretty loud, so we can't go crazy.
No.
But in Celtic Women and in Riverdance, they have some fabulous musicians who come in with full percussion sets, and they're playing bongos and a lot of Afro and mixing stuff in into the... It's really morphed into world music, for sure.
You, as a teacher, Adrian, have been doing this for a while, and you set very high standards and levels for your young people.
Yeah, I do. I just believe that everyone can do it. And I know it's true in theory for a lot of people, but I really try to bring it into the classroom and really try to individually encourage every dancer. And it's proven out. Where there have been dancers that really were sort of the underdogs, and one of them just won the national title in October, and she was sort of not anyone that anyone was looking at. You just don't know.
this is a competitive dance. You can mm-hmm. you can not just in the United States, it's a worldwide mm-hmm. phenomenon. Now, have you, Natalie, gone to any of these competitions?
Yeah, we try to compete at least once a year. We go all around the country. It's a lot of fun.
What's it
it's
like?
A lot of fun. You know, for our company, it's not competitive within our group. So it's just we're having fun. We're supporting each other. Our CRN, our organization that we're a part of, isn't really that competitive either. So it's really, you know, friendly. We watch other girls dance. We, you know, talk about how much we love dance. You know, it's a fun time, definitely.
They hang out at the awards together, like yeah. all the schools intermix down in front, right. and they, it's pretty nice.
Now, do you find yourself competing against people from Ireland?
Mm-hmm. And the last 2 years, we've had a international. They're calling it the North American Nationals, and this will be the third year coming up this October that they're holding it. And it's about half and half, so it's been 200 to 250 competitors, and about half are coming over from Ireland. And then we can also go to Ireland and compete. And it was the Irish Open. I think this year they're changing, or next year they're changing it to the World Championships, because now they do have schools in Australia and China and Russia and all over the place.
Amazing. So it's just like an international phenomenon. It's a kind of dance that's just taken hold, like tango and salsa and things like that.
Yeah, I was surprised to know. I did a little research after I talked to you, and I was surprised to find out that the U.S. organization, there's three Irish dance organizations, but there's one main one in the U.S., and that's not the one we belong to. But they were established in 1964 in New York, and that surprised me because I knew it was established before Riverdance, which was around 1995, but I didn't realize how far back it actually went.
What's it like when you compete against Irish dancers from Ireland?
It's taken us a couple years to get to feel like we're comfortable and competing with like material and to feel like we're competitive. But I think this year, this last October in particular, I think we felt really successful with what we brought, and we had a first and second in one of the championships and a fourth in the other. And I think we're finally feeling like we've hit our stride in relation to the Irish. They've been doing it forever.
That's amazing. I mean, I would think of going to Cuba for a salsa contest or something like that. You wouldn't even want to set foot in there.
It can be a little scary, but I think we've been competing for... Bella Sama's been established in 2006, but some of the girls were competing several years before that. And I competed in the 90s, actually. I was competing before Riverdance came out. So, you know, it's just one of those things. After a while, you get used to it. It just sort of feels comfortable.
Do you still dance?
I do. I dance a lot. I don't tend to dance in the performances. I tend to sing in the performances, mostly because if anyone's going to forget the choreography, it's going to be me. I have too much going in my head as a director,
right.
and it's really hard for me to change hats in the context of the show. So you will see me occasionally jump out. I'll jump out at the end.
What are the ages of the people in the company?
See, we have as young as 5 yep. up to... Over 60. 70s.
We have a 179.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I asked him his birthday. He's 79.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So it really is one of those dance forms that you can do your whole life.
You can, and there's several varieties of Irish dance. The step dancing is the most vigorous. The Seanos dancing, which is Seanos means old style in Irish, and that's much lower to the ground, extremely percussive. It's very rhythmic. And so that's, you see a lot of, most of the Seanos dancers are much older, and they've been dancing Seanos their whole lives, and they're still in their 70s and 80s.
When you talk about the percussive rhythms, the rhythms of Irish dance, what is their relationship to other European rhythms? I mean, where are their roots? Is it just utterly, completely indigenous?
You know, that's a really hard question. There are certain things, the 9/8 slip jigs, you don't hear in a lot of other music, but reels that are in 4/4 time, we can dance reels to a lot of different world rhythms. Sometimes the tempos aren't as comfortable. The Irish tempos tend to be very fast. But yeah, there's a lot, and the hornpipe rhythms, which is really related to swing, they feel very similar. We're using actual swing music. I'm using you know, some Tuxedo Junction and Sing 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 in the show, and that works very well with the 4/4 hornpipes that Irish uses. So,
is there any partner dancing?
Yeah, we have a style called Kaylee, which is multiple people. It's not just partner. There can be two people. It's a lot of, you know, hands, you know, just group partner
patterns.
Yeah. You know.
They call it, they have Kaylee dancing, and then they also have figure dancing, and the Kayleys have figures in them.
So if you're watching from above, you see the patterns kind of
thing?
Yeah,
and it's, I mean, I suppose it's similar to contra dancing and square dancing in that regard.
Right. So this is all girls?
No. We have five. My 79-year-old is a male.
Okay.
And then I have two teenage boys and two younger boys around 10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'd love to have more boys. Come dance with me if you want to.
Is it an equal number?
It'd be fun. It's not generally boys and dance all over is the same. You know, modern dance, ballet. I think it's just boys do a lot of sports and don't do as much dance.
Yeah, in this country anyway.
Yeah. I have to tell you, my oldest boy is really thrilled to be the only one of his age around 30 girls. He doesn't mind it at all.
Nice work if you can get it.
Yep.
So, Adrian, not only do you do choreography, but you've got students doing it as well.
I do. I actually start them once they know their first four dances, because Irish dancing is in levels. You teach them by level, and you don't wait till they're ready next year to move on. You just start moving through the levels. But once they learn their first four beginner dances, I start having them learn how to choreograph. It does two things for me and for them, and she's really good at this. It creates an environment where they feel confident if they forget something. It's in a performance or in a competition, they can keep going.
Because you know how to choreograph, so
yes.
You just improvise.
Exactly.
Yes. And she's had some amazing moments in competition where she's just pulled it out, and the judge didn't know she still placed, and she choreographed like 8 whole bars one time in the middle of a dance and then got back into it.
What
I don't know how
like?
She does that.
You know, you're not really thinking. It's in the moment where you're like, just keep going, just keep dancing, and, you know, it's not really scary. It comes to you. If you know the music, if you know basic steps, it just comes to you.
You can fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
And then I have four student pieces in the show that they've choreographed. So as they get more advanced, they move up from steps. Irish dancing is all in 8-bar steps. So you do a step on the right and a step on the left, which is why it's called step dancing. And so when you choreograph, I start out teaching steps. But then once they get better at steps, then we start visualizing patterns on the stage and entrances and exits. And does it really relate to the music? They have to find their piece of music. They have to decide what lighting they're interested in, what costume they're interested in. So it's all, it's just a really great exercise and experience. And one of the things I've started doing with her group, with the advanced group, in my company, is we've actually now gone out and started to improvise and be able to improvise with live musicians and create little pieces and things on the fly, which I think is awesome. And it's fun for me to watch them do that. And now I don't have to, not everything looks like me anymore. It looks like them.
Right.
Which is way more interesting than just me.
And you've got student musicians.
I do have student musicians. I have two fiddle players who are playing in the show and several other up-and-coming fiddle players. There's a whistle player. There's actually a whole family. I have a family of 5 that all play and sing, and that's one of the pieces that we're doing in the show.
Like, you know, mom, dad, and the kids kind of family?
Yeah,
of 5?
It's a smaller Von Trapp. And I'm actually not singing the lead on the song that they're doing. The oldest girl is. I'm just going to help them and play the baron and sing a little bit in the background. And we've been going out and taking our live music to our shows at the Renaissance Fair. And not all of our pieces are live, but a lot of them we've been choreographing to live music, which has been great. We're trying next year. I think we're hoping to get into one of the festivals, folk festivals in Belgium. And really, that's a live music venue. You know, we're not going to take our canned CD music and go dance. So the whole show will be live. and I love having musicians in my group. If you play, come dance for me.
Excellent. Now, this is an international culture of, so I guess, subculture all over the place of Irish dance. And what about in New Mexico? I mean, you've got this group. Has it caught on? Do you have a lot of people wanting to join?
I have 50 or so students currently. There actually are 3 Irish dance schools in New Mexico. There's 2 in Albuquerque. But I have 50 current students. I'm constantly getting asked. I get asked by a lot of parents of really young children, 3- and 4-year-olds. And what I tell them is that it's actually fairly structured. It doesn't look as structured as it is. And so I like to let them just play and keep bopping around to the Irish music because that's what's really fun. And then I start to introduce that structure at about 5. So that's why I wait a little bit to start dancing. But so I usually get about, 5 calls a month for 3-year-olds. So send them to creative movement classes and then bring them to me at 5.
Yeah, or put the CDs on in your house and
absolutely.
Just let them move, and I imagine they'll kind of come up with their own.
Irish music is infectious like that. It's just you can't sit still. You can't not move. And that's why we do it, I think, or that's at least why we get started, is the music. I got started because of the Chieftains. I went to a Chieftains show and they had dancers and I just thought they were great and, I always loved the music and I was like, I'm going to do this. And I looked in the phone book and there was a school. I was in California and there was a school there and that's where I learned.
And the rest is history.
Yep, the rest is history. And we're having a great time.
Adrienne Bellis is artistic director of Belisama Irish Dance. They're at Belisama, Belisama, irishdance.com. Natalie Smith is dance captain, and Rhythm of Fire 2011 is Saturday at 7 o'clock and Sunday at 2:30 at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For more information, 670-1325. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. We're at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.